Welcome to That Season Air podcast. I'm your host, Gina. Stick with me as I chat to season airs, expats and adventurers across the world, sharing their inspiring stories and interesting insights into living and working abroad. On today's show, I catch up with workawayer and digital nomad, Charlotte Seibert. Originally from Germany, Charlotte came in to talk us through her travel journey from her time working in the music industry in London to her workaway adventures across Japan, South America, Mexico and Europe. Tune in as we deep dive into hitchhiking and couchsurfing, Charlotte shares her travel hacks and advice, and stick with us right to the end of the show as we hear how human kindness prevailed after a terrifying mugging experience in Lima.
I was very shaken. It took a while to gain my confidence again.
Yeah, I bet.
But immediately, it also showed me, like, yeah, there's some bad people. Of course, there's bad people out there, but there's also so much goodness in the world.
If you enjoy the podcast and want to show your support for the show, you are now able to buy me a coffee via the link in the show notes. And without further ado, here's the show.
Welcome to the show, Charlotte.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
It's lovely to finally meet you. So you were nominated by my mum because you went to her house as a workaway. Is the right term workaway or workawayer?
Workawayer is what you say, yeah. It sounds a bit funny, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's the organization of the platform is called Workaway, and I did a workaway with her. But yeah, I'm a workawayer.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from originally? And what are you doing at the moment? Where are you? What's your current situation?
Yes, so I'm from Germany. I am, I think 35 years old now. I'm currently back in Germany mainly because of the pandemic, and I work as a VA these days, so a virtual assistant.
What sparked the interest into travel and going and doing the workaway thing?
I think I've always really enjoyed traveling, and I always liked the idea already in school of going abroad and experiencing different cultures and all. So I actually I moved abroad for the first time when I was, I think I just turned 19. So I did my Abitur, which is like the German A levels, and then I moved to London for half a year, and I just worked in a bar and went to loads of gigs and club nights, and I was really into music at the time. Still am, and I really love British music, so London was where I wanted to be. I ended up moving back there after university and lived there for 8 years. So I'm quite used to living abroad. I also did a semester abroad in Dublin. I was quite fortunate to get some kind of stipendium. Now it's called Erasmus Plus. It had a different name back then, but it's basically like an Erasmus for graduates. They help you go abroad and do an internship abroad. So I got one of those spots, moved back to London in 2000, I think it was. And the agency where I did the internship ended up offering me a job. To be honest, I didn't care much about the agency or the job. I just wanted to stay in London longer.
Okay.
And that's kind of, yeah, that was the start of it. And then I stumbled into the music industry, which was awesome. And yeah.
What did you actually study at uni? And then was that something that you went into from there?
No, not at all. Story of my life, I've always been very clueless what to do with myself. I never had much of a plan. When I had just finished school, I met someone who had studied English with business as the minor subject, and she had argued that it's a really good combination because, you know, it's, you can do a lot of things with that, but you're not really forced into anything like maybe art history or something. So I thought, yeah that's good. Gives me like 3 more years to figure out what I want to do. And yeah, that's what I ended up studying. So it was English literature, linguistics and history, and then with business studies as my minor.
Oh, wow. So how did you stumble into the music industry in London?
Through a lot of luck. I met someone in a pub who worked in the music industry, and we started chatting, and he kept asking me about my job, and I was working at this marketing agency and not particularly excited about it. So I was like, oh, let's talk about something else. Why are we talking about work? He was like, why are you doing something that you don't enjoy? And it's like, yeah, fair point. And and he asked me what I was into, and it had always been a dream of mine to work in the music industry, but I didn't quite know what to do. And he ended up taking me to just a drinks thing where there were loads of people. It was basically the Ivor Novello Awards, which is a big songwriter and publishing awards ceremony, and there were some after drinks in a pub after that show, and he just took me along to that. So I met loads of people that worked in the industry, and the next day I had an email from someone who was like, I think we were talking last night and I think you were interested in working in the music industry and we could really use some help here. And that's basically how I fell into it. Yeah.
Wow. And what were you doing while you were in the industry? What sort of job was it?
So I worked in the sync industry. So placing music in films and adverts, computer games, film trailers.
And did you enjoy that work?
Yes, it was a dream come true, really. It's a really fun industry. It's a very social industry. You obviously get to go to a lot of gigs. And I had a really, really great time working in that industry. It was just that towards the end of it, I reached a point after all these years where it was like, is this really it? And I also, which I never thought would happen, but I reached a point where going to gigs 3 times a week, or if I didn't go to gigs, I was going to networking events and award shows and whatever. You know, you're constantly socializing within the industry, which is what makes this industry so great. But after a while, it also gets a little bit tiring. And it got to the point where over the weekend, I normally didn't want to do anything anymore because I was so tired from the weeknights. I think towards the end of it, I fell a little bit out of love with it. And I started to see the negatives more, like how expensive life was there and how hectic and busy. And
London's crazy.
Yes, it is. Exactly. So I was starting to notice that more and more. And I was asking myself whether I still wanted to be there. And I didn't really have an alternative plan. So I was thinking about maybe going back to Germany, maybe to Berlin or maybe Hamburg, but I couldn't really see myself in any of those places. But I also didn't feel like staying in London much longer. So I had a bit of a crisis, I think. And eventually I felt like I just needed to get away for a bit to clear my head and to get some distance from London. And I thought maybe if I'm gone for a couple of months, maybe I'll realize that I really miss it and I start seeing the positives again. Or maybe I'll come up with another idea or something. So that's kind of how it started. And how I got into Workaway was I'd been thinking for a while how I would travel. And I think one of the reasons why it took me so long to make this decision was that I wasn't really sure how to travel, because to be honest, I've never been a huge fan of staying in hostels anyway. I was already over 30 at the time. I couldn't really see myself like backpack and sleep in bunk beds and massive dorms and all. But I didn't want to be just a tourist going from one hotel room or Airbnb to the next. So I couldn't quite picture how I wanted to travel. And a few months before, a friend had told me about Workaway for the first time, because she and her friends had been using it as hosts. So they had built this old house in Berlin that was completely falling apart and they needed help building it back up, and they had no money to do so. So they turned to Workaway and invited people from around the world who helped them build the house back up. And I met some of them. Some of them ended up living with them in the house now. And I just loved the concept. I'd never quite heard of anything like it. I think the only thing I knew was woofing, which is like working on farms. I think it's done in like mainly Australia or New Zealand. But I wasn't that keen on farm work. And Workaway kind of can be farm work as well, but there's really anything is possible with Workaway. So I started looking into it. And as soon as I started the platform, I kind of knew, that's what I want to do. That's how I want to travel.
So where was it the first place that you went?
My first Workaway was in Italy. When I decided that I wanted, this was the way I was going to travel, the next big question was, where do I go? Loads of people actually said like, oh, you're taking time off, like, where are you going? Southeast Asia or South America? And I was like, well, actually, I was thinking Europe. Loads of people were a bit like, oh, that's so dull, it's just around the corner and whatever. But because it was the first time I was traveling on my own, like, you know, I've traveled abroad to visit friends abroad or family or something, but I'd never actually done a proper solo trip on my own. And I wasn't really scared I would get homesick or something, because I'm very used to not being in the same country mm-hmm. as my family, and my friends are all over the place, but still I didn't know if it was for me because I'd just never done anything like it. So I just wanted to really carefully test the water. And Italy has always been kind of my happy place. I really, really love Italy. And I'd been there 3 or 4 times before. And I thought, what better place to start than this country that I know I love. And yeah, so my first placement was in Tuscany. Basically, the way it works is it's a platform. You know, you can imagine it a little bit like something like Airbnb. It's a website where you can go on and search the region you want to go to and see what's available. You can also filter by what kind of work interests you. So you could be house sitting or pet sitting, gardening. It can be construction work. It can be teaching languages, looking after children. There's really like endless possibilities. The way it works is that you stay with people and they provide the accommodation and the food. And in return, you do some work for them. So Workaway themselves suggests that you do 5 days a week and no more than 5 hours a day, so 25 hours a week in total. But really, it's up to you and the host what you arrange. So oftentimes, I just did 3 hours a day. Sometimes I did a bit more. Some people don't provide the food, but they also expect a little less work. So you really agree it with the host. But 5 hours a day is kind of what Workaway suggests.
And is there any sort of joining fee for that platform, or is it just you go on and sign up?
So it's free to browse the platform. And I spent a few days just kind of clicking through. And as you click through, you keep seeing like suggestions on the side. Or if you like this, you might also like that. And I just got completely carried away reading through hundreds of profiles. But once you want to contact a host, you do need to pay a fee to make that contact. But it's, I think when I joined, which was now 4 years ago or 3 years ago, I think it was something like €28 for a year or something. So it's not a lot of money, and you pay that once, right, and then you can contact as many hosts as you want to.
Initially, how long did you decide on going and doing the Workaway thing for?
My original plan was just to take some time off and, you know, clear my head a little bit. But I was thinking, I told everyone probably 3 or 4 months, but I never set an end date. My old boss actually offered to, you know, hold my job for me, that I could take a break and come back. And I was like, I don't know if I want that. I think, you know, if I really enjoy it, I wanted the option to keep extending it. But 3 to 4 months was my initial plan. And yeah, it didn't work out.
How long did you end up going for?
It ended up being over 2 years.
You caught the travel bug.
Completely, yeah. And it was funny how quickly it went. It was at the end of my first Workaway after 2 weeks and I'd only had this one experience, but it was a really great experience. And I just knew like, okay, no, 3 months, 4 months, it's never going to be enough. I wasn't quite planning on this long, but yeah.
So how was your experience in Italy?
It was amazing. I was really lucky with the host families, my hosts in general. I did kind of 3 to 4 Workaways. I was meant to be doing 4, but then one cancelled on me because the guy basically had forgotten that I was supposed to be coming. And then a few days before I messaged him, I was like, hey, I was thinking of taking this train. Does that work for you? And he was like, oh no, I forgot you're coming. I forgot somebody else here. No. Sorry. But that was actually great. Things like that kept happening where it just like turned out for the better, because I ended up contacting the next host I was supposed to be staying with and asked her if I could come a bit earlier. And she had family visiting, so she couldn't host me any earlier. But she said, oh, let me ask my friend. And she introduced me to, well, it turned out to be her next door neighbor and best friend. Okay. And she was fantastic. So amazing that I ended up, I think I spent 3.5 weeks with her. And even when I was supposed to be going to that first woman, I ended up just staying in Monica, her name is, in her house. And then just they kind of shared me between them.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, I did mainly gardening, some cleaning and cooking, taking care of animals, things like that.
Was it the plan to spend the whole 3 or 4 months in Italy, just in Italy, or did you go elsewhere in that time?
I had made plans for 6 weeks in Italy. And then after that, I kind of wanted to see what happens. But then I had such a great time in Italy that I kept extending it. So I ended up staying there for, I think, around 2 months in total. And then from mm-hmm. Italy, I went to Greece, and then France, and then Croatia.
Excellent. Yeah. And France is where you met my
mom. Exactly.
Yeah, because she told me all about you coming and everything. And then when I started the podcast, she was like, you have to talk to Charlotte. She's not a seasonaire, but she's done loads of stuff and she's got this really exciting life. And ever since she's been gone as well, she's done all these amazing things. So I was like, let's get her
on. I
love
your mom and Igloo. Oh my God, your dog is like, or her dog is the best. I could have stolen him right away.
I know, he's amazing. Yes. Yeah, he's got his own Instagram.
I know, so I follow him.
Oh, you got it?
Of course.
Amazing. Yes, so anyway, let's get back on track. So you did a bit of Europe and then your 4 months was up. What happened after that?
I knew very quickly that the 4 months weren't going to be enough. And just before leaving, I had been at an event in Amsterdam and I talked to this, another woman that works in the music industry. And she'd been to Japan a few times and told me how amazing it was. And it really kind of sparked my interest. So I was reading loads about it. It was like, I never thought about going there. And then I thought, okay, I've done Europe now. I've done the safe kind of close by traveling. Let's go somewhere a bit further away. And I found a really good cheap flight to Japan. So I got myself a one-way ticket there.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And then it didn't quite work out as I had planned. But again, it kind of turned out for the best because I booked my flight. And then I started applying for workaways, and it had been really, really easy to find hosts in Europe. Mm-hmm. And somehow in Japan, everybody just ignored me. And the few people that did reply, just didn't have any availability. So in the end, I just managed to get one workaway there, which was actually with a British guy who lives out there. And other than that, I thought, okay, now I've got my ticket there. It's quite an expensive country to go traveling. I didn't really have that many savings left and the workaway plan didn't work out. But that then led to me trying out couchsurfing and hitchhiking for the first time, which then completely changed the way I traveled from then on. So it was a great thing in the end.
That's amazing. So when you say hitchhiking and couch surfing, is there like a community of people that do this that you can find online? Or because to me, hitchhiking is you go, you know, you want to go somewhere, you stick your thumb out and you get a lift. Is there now, I guess, some kind of app for that? Or what's the situation? How do you get into that?
So not for hitchhiking. I mean, there are things like BlaBlaCar. I think actually when I went to visit your mom, I'm pretty sure that I took a BlaBlaCar. So it's like a car share thing. It's great. You know, you pay them a small amount and there's an app or you go on the platform and you can arrange a lift. But no, the hitchhiking, I just did spontaneously. I did some research. I Googled it. It was like, you know, I'd never done it before. So I wasn't really sure what to expect. But I read on some travel blog somewhere that it's not very common in Japan.
Oh, okay.
But it's a very safe country and people really want to treat visitors well and help you. So it was a good first place to try it out. I can confirm that it's not very common there. I had occasions where I was standing on the side of the road with my thumbs out and people would drive past in their car and just like do a thumbs up back at me and just like smile at me. And it's like, okay, like I'm not just greeting you or something. I'm doing this for a reason. But, and I asked every person that I hitchhike with if they had taken somebody before. And I must have I went along with dozens of people. I was there for, I think, 6 or 7 weeks. And only one single person had taken a hitchhiker before. That guy had told him some sob story, how he'd been mugged and had no money. So he gave him some money, which that guy promised to pay back and obviously never did. So the one experience he had was a bad one. And he still decided to take me along. And he's like, yes, of course. It's not, you know, you've got nothing to do with it. And it's like, of course not. But so it's been amazing. And for couchsurfing, yes, there is a platform. So couchsurfing is a website or an app as well. Since the pandemic, I think you pay a very small membership fee. It's not a lot. It's like, I think it might be around like €9 a year or something. But again, it's kind of like Airbnb or something. It's a platform. You say where you're going, if you have any preferences, if you're happy to share a room or if you prefer having your own room, for example. And then you can find possible hosts and contact them through the platform. And there's also some other similar sites. There's a Facebook group that I really love that was started while I was traveling. That's called Host a Sister. And it's It's exactly like couchsurfing, but it's only for women hosting women. And I used that a few times as well, because I found that I actually only stayed with one woman in my whole time of traveling through couchsurfing, because there's just a lot more guys on the platform. And yeah, so Host a Sister, I can highly recommend. It's a really great group.
That's so good. It makes solo female travelers as well.
Exactly.
A bit more comfortable and confident. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, awesome.
So I traveled in Japan, I think, for 6 or 7 weeks. Mm-hmm. I started in Tokyo and then slowly worked my way down to Nagasaki and then slightly back up again to Fukuoka, which is where I left from. But yeah, so I traveled across the islands in Japan, did it entirely by hitchhiking. And it was one of the absolute highlights of my trip, because it's a lot of people have always asked me, like, is it not dangerous? Did you never feel like, you know, unsafe or something? But I think that the way I travel brought me so much closer to the people. Mm-hmm. Because when you are in somebody's car, you very quickly connect with them, and they very quickly start telling you quite personal things, and they give you amazing tips, like where you should go. Like, if, you know, if I told them, oh, I want to go there because I want to see this famous temple, I want to do this hike, a lot of the time they would be like, oh yeah, but you know what you really should do is this hike. Not a lot of people know it, because, you know, it's not in the guidebooks, but it's actually way more beautiful and not that touristy and all. And Japan,
to get the local knowledge.
Exactly. And Japan was especially amazing for hitchhiking, because the Japanese have this culture of, they treat guests just incredibly well. Part of their culture is just to be as welcoming and kind as possible to visitors. And every single person who gave me a ride would make me some kind of present that ranged from like, you know, an orange or something, to some people bought me an entire cake box. And I was like, I'm traveling on my own. What am I supposed to do with this massive cake box? But it was great fun, because I would then like arrive in a hostel or at my new couch surfing host. I'd be like, hey, I brought cake. Okay. everyone that I hitchhiked with in Japan would invite me for lunch. And in the beginning, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, no, like, let me get the lunch, because, you know, you're already doing me a massive favor. You're taking me along, like, let me get it. But they would always insist on getting the lunch for me. And then if I had had just lunch with somebody else, I'd be like, oh, it's fine, I'm not hungry, I just ate. Then they'd be like, oh, but maybe coffee or tea or maybe ice cream. I could get you some ice cream. It's like, you don't have to get me anything. But it's a big, like, making gifts and treating people is such a big part of their culture. So I learned very quickly to always like have something to give back. I found this shop that was in all the main like train stations and big shopping malls and all, that sold some German chocolate. So I would always go and like buy a big stack so I could give so something cute. Back to people, which was really amazing. And yeah, a lot of the people that I rode with as well, they offered me to like stay at their houses and things like that. So it's, yeah, it's an incredibly like welcoming culture there. And some people had actually warned me before, especially after spending so much time in Italy. They were like, oh, but, you know, Japan is really different. Like, you probably don't know what to expect. Like, the Japanese, they're very reserved and, you know, a bit cold. And, you know, you might struggle to connect with people there. And I had the complete opposite experience. For me, there were some of the kindest, warmest people I've met. And I think that a big part of that is because of the way I traveled, because I didn't take the Shinkansen train and just stayed in hostels and all, but I actually, you know, stayed with the locals and I traveled with the locals and I was in their cars and in their houses. And it was a really great experience.
Yeah, sounds amazing. Where did you go after Japan? What was next on your journey?
From Japan, I went to New Zealand for 2 months.
Okay. So in New Zealand, they're very used to hitchhiking.
They are. Yes, they are very much. So there I traveled kind of from the northern tip of the North Island to the southern tip, all the way down. In between, I got a car for a few days and then ended up taking hitchhikers with me to kind of return the favor. Yeah, and I did 3 more workaways there. And they were kind of the last ones before going to South America.
When we were chatting over the email and you gave me a little bit of information about you, you've been to many countries, so we decided on a few that you were just gonna touch on instead of going through the whole history.
Yes.
Like you said, you also went to Mexico and South America and various different places. What were a few highlights from there? Tell us a little bit about where you went and how it was.
One of my absolute highlights was Patagonia. It's by far the most beautiful in terms of the countryside that I've ever seen. Traveling there, I cried several times just because I was so overwhelmed by how beautiful the nature was, the amazing glaciers and there's everything from glaciers to volcanoes, and it's really, really stunning. And I traveled Patagonia by hitchhiking as well. I actually traveled more than half of Chile just by hitchhiking as well. So I New Zealand, I arrived in Santiago in Chile, and I flew down to Punta Arenas, which is the southernmost city in Chile. And then from there, I really slowly hitchhiked back up to Santiago, which was also an incredible experience, because very different to Japan, because Patagonia is so remote. And, you know, sometimes you'd arrive in a small village and there would just be a tiny, like 10 square meter shop or something. And sometimes it would be closed for 2 days because the owner was taking a break or something. And you'd be there and it's like, okay, there's no restaurant, there's no cafe, there's no shop. What are you going to do? But it was really, really cool to travel there. And I was also quite lucky because I was traveling on my own, and I learned very quickly that hitchhiking, it's definitely easier when you're a solo female traveler, because quite often there'd be like big groups of people traveling together, or two guys or couples. And usually I think as a woman, there's just a bit less threat, I guess. So people were more inclined to give me a ride. So yeah.
Finally, we get something in our favor.
Exactly. One thing.
When you go to these countries, did you study a bit of the language before you went, or did you just go and wing it while you were there?
I completely winged it. So in Japan, I tried, but I thought it was a very difficult language to learn. But I learned with the first guy that I hitchhiked with, this quite old, like 70 something year old guy. He just got out his phone and like he gave me a signal to just like wait a second, got out his phone and was like, what is he doing? And he downloaded a translation app. And like in Japan, they're very good with technology. So everyone, no matter how old, like they're always on their phones, and there's like, oh, there's probably an app for it. And up until then, I didn't even know that there's app where you can actually talk into the phone and it will translate it for you. That was the way I communicated in Japan. We just always like spoke in our language, or I did like German or English and they did it in Japanese, and then it would translate it. And it was quite funny because obviously sometimes you could then it also writes down what it thinks you said. So sometimes they would like give you a confused look, and then I'd like, you know, show me the phone again. It's like, oh, no, that's not what I meant to ask. The phone didn't understand it right. But yeah, that was a very fun way of communicating in Japan. And then when I arrived in South America, all I could speak really was, you know, kind of holiday Spanish. So I could like say my name and yeah, like order a beer, things like that, and say hi and bye and thank you, but not much more than that. But the great thing about traveling there was that, especially once you leave the big city, Santiago, and you go to Patagonia, which is so remote, people just don't speak English. They speak Spanish and that's it. So you have to adapt. And because I was hitchhiking and I was in the car with these people who didn't speak English or German so many hours, I had to very quickly learn the language. And the questions were always the same. It was always like, where is your husband? It's like, oh, there is no husband. Oh, but your boyfriend. It's like, no, there's no boyfriend either. It's like, but who are you traveling with? On my own. It's like, what? And where are your children? It's like, oh, I have no children. But you said you're 32. Why do you not have children? And then they would always talk about the rain and the wind and all the things that are like really typical for Patagonia. And so, yeah, very, very quickly picked up some basic vocabulary. And then I downloaded Duolingo as well while I was there. So I tried to practice a little bit in the evenings and all. But now I get by really well with my Spanish. I think it sucks. It's really bad. I just speak in the present tense and I know no grammar at all. But I tend to just think of like the word that feels closest in. I speak a bit of French and a few words of Italian and then English and German. So I just think of the word that feels most appropriate and then try and make it sound Spanish, and it somehow works. And yeah, I now get by very well with my broken Spanish.
Oh, that's awesome.
Actually, while I was talking, I just remembered something from Japan. Like, it was quite an experience. My very first couch surfing experience, which was in Kyoto. the host there, which was, she was a medicine student. She told me, yeah, you can definitely stay with us. Sounds great. But just so you know, we don't have a bathroom. We just have a toilet. So you have to go to the public bathroom if you want to take a shower. And she just said, you know, just in case you're a bit prude or something, you should know this. And I was like, oh, I don't know how I feel about like showering in front of other people and whatever. But then I thought, you know, I don't know anyone there. I'm never going to see them again. So let's try it. So they arrived there and it was this beautiful old Japanese house. But yes, they only had the toilet and that was it. And this girl I was staying with, she just started to study medicine and they were kind of starting to take bodies apart. So she picked me up at the train station and just right away went, oh, I like skinned someone for the first time today. Do you mind if we go straight to the bathhouse? And it's like, no, sure, that's fine. So they're called Sentos and it was down the road and it was really amazing. I knew her for about half an hour and then we kind of got undressed in front of each other and washed ourselves in front of each other, which was a really bizarre experience, but something I started to enjoy so much. Like in my time there, it became this ritual every night to go to the Sento. And basically it's a bathhouse and it's not uncommon in Japan at all. A lot of the houses there, the old houses still don't have their own bathrooms. Mm-hmm. So the Sento is split in like the men's and the women's area and you undress in one room mm-hmm. and then you enter the shower room and it's not proper showers like we would know them, but you take a little like plastic stool and you sit like very close to the ground and there's this tiny shower head and you wash yourself sitting on this little stool and you have to be really, really thorough. Like cleanliness is, and hygiene is very important in Japan. So you sit there and like really thoroughly like shower everything, make sure there's like, yeah, no dirt left on you. And then after that, there's several different pools that you can go into. So it's a little bit like a spa. So you have these little whirlpools and they put different like additives like to it. So some have like minerals in them and they have different colors and whatever. And heat gets hotter and hotter from each pool to the next. So I could only do two of them. And it was just me and my host. And then all the other ladies there were like probably over 80 and they all just smiled at me and thought it was so funny that I was there with them. And then they all started laughing at me because I went into the first pool and immediately just went bright red because it was way too hot for me. And the final pool I could just like dip my finger in because it was like boiling water to me, and the old ladies just sat in there and smiled at me and I just like dipped my finger. I was like, how do you do this? And the weirdest pool in there was one that's electric. My host was like, oh, you have to try this one. It's like, I don't know, this sounds dangerous. I'm not sure if I want to do this. So she went in first and just went like, the key thing is to just get in really quickly. It's like, okay. So basically there's like an electric current running through. But if you stand in it, it's kind of at the height of like your bum and your belly. And when it's like at those kind of fatty areas, you just feel it like slightly vibrating on your body. And that unpleasant, although I wouldn't really call it pleasant either. But if you just like put your finger in the water, it's proper like zipping. It's really uncomfortable.
Really?
Yeah. So I think it's meant to be relaxing, but I just got in once for the experience. But yeah, that was like the first time round, I felt a little bit uncomfortable and I think I was bright red the whole time and thought, oh God, what a weird experience. But from then on, it became this ritual to go down to the center every evening at the end of my day. I ended up staying with them for, I think, well over a week. They were such lovely hosts and we got on really well. And at the end of each day of like walking around Kyoto and exploring the city, I would go to the Sento and there was this lovely lady at the entrance with two dogs, always like one sitting at each side, and they would greet me every evening. And then all the old ladies would recognize me and greet me. And yeah, it became a really lovely ritual in Japan.
Cool. You became a bit of a local.
Yes.
That's so cute. Awesome. Going back to South America, were you still doing work away? In fact, with all these places, how do you choose where you want to go?
So I did my last workaways in New Zealand, and then at the last workaway, I had kind of a small accident and like chipped my finger a little bit and hurt my back a little bit. So I couldn't really physically do any workaways when I arrived in South America. And then it was obviously a lot cheaper to travel in South America as well compared to New Zealand and Japan.
Had you saved a little bit of money before you went?
Yes. So there I was mainly living off savings and then again doing couch surfing and a lot of hitchhiking. But I never had much of a plan. So when I was in New Zealand and I knew I wanted to travel a bit more, I just sat down and looked at the map and thought, okay, South America, Southeast Asia. And then I looked at flights. The cheapest flights to South America were Buenos Aires and Santiago. And I read that at that time of the year, Buenos Aires was really, really hot. So I was like, fine, I'll go to Santiago then. Mm-hmm. And then I just posted on Facebook that I'm going to Chile in like 2 days and ask if anyone had any recommendations for traveling in South America. And that was kind of the first guidance I got. And then I didn't immediately find a couchsurfing host in Santiago, but I had contacted a guy and he had other people staying with him, but then suggested that we could still meet for a coffee. And we did. And he's become a really, really good friend since. He's come to visit me in Hamburg Christmas. And yeah, he's great. And him and his best friend became really good friends of mine. They gave me so many tips for like where I have to go in Chile, but then also the rest of South America. And kind of as I was traveling and met other travelers and also other couch surfing hosts, they just kept telling me about places. Mm-hmm. And were like, oh, you can't miss this. You have to go there. And, you know, some places I was like Machu Picchu, for example, I wasn't so sure about going. I did in the end because loads of people said you'll probably regret not going. But I was worried it might be too touristy and it was definitely way too touristy for me. But other places people told me about that hadn't even crossed my mind before. I'd never heard about them before. And the way that people described it, I just thought, yep, that will be my next stop. Sounds great. So like that was the whole idea. And I think also why I eventually stopped doing Workaway, because with Workaway, there was some kind of commitment. Like I had to commit to being in a certain place mm-hmm. by a certain date. When I arrived in South America, I just started traveling extremely spontaneously. I ended up staying in Santiago for over 3 weeks in the mm-hmm. end, which I didn't think would interest me very much. And some people had told me, oh no, Santiago was probably like compared to other cities in South America, really boring. But I met so many great people there that I loved it there, and I ended up staying there for a really long time. And being able to go to places and just stay a night or two if I wasn't really feeling them, or staying a whole month because something there just clicked, that's what I really enjoyed about the way I was traveling.
Yeah. So what are a few other places you went while you were there?
From Chile, I did it, yeah, in Patagonia. I briefly went to Argentina as well, and then I went on to Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, including Galapagos and Colombia. Probably my overall highlight of my entire trip was going to Galapagos. It was like a childhood dream come true because I'm a huge animal lover, as your mom knows.
Yes, she told me.
Yes, I just love all animals. And it was one of those places where I thought, oh, maybe I'm building this up to be, you know, this incredible place. Hopefully I won't be disappointed. And some people actually told me like, oh no, it's too expensive and you have to pay so much to get there. It's not really worth it. But luckily I had the best experience there. So it's not super cheap to go. Like you have to pay, I think $100 or something just as an entry to the national park. And obviously the flights to get there. But I actually ended up couch surfing on two of the three islands I visited. So again, didn't have to pay for accommodation. And the one place I stayed at wasn't that expensive either. And if you just kind of eat what grows on the islands, it's really not that expensive. The only thing that's really expensive there is if you want to do tours and excursions. So I'd started scuba diving in South America. I learned it in Colombia, and that was relatively expensive compared, for example, compared mm-hmm. to Colombia, scuba diving in Galapagos was very expensive. So I only did it one day, but I actually ended up spending most of my time on San Cristobal Island, which is where there's the big sea lion colonies. And I really just spent most of my day there going down to the sea and playing with the sea lions all day, every day. Oh, and really? It's like, oh, wow. If you like dogs, then yeah, it's like playing with dogs, but even more awesome because you're in the water with them and they're sea lions. And they're so curious and they really want to interact. And a lot of people were just filming them or taking pictures and like observing them. And then they very quickly disappear mm-hmm. again. But if you interact with them a little bit, like you obviously don't touch them or anything, but if you splash them with water or if you dive a little bit down with them, they just keep coming back for more and you can play with them for hours. And yeah, that was, oh, really? That was incredible. One of the best experiences of my life.
Were they in the wild?
Yes. Yes,
oh, right.
It's the great thing for me about Galapagos is that I've never been anywhere like it. Like, to me, it immediately felt like the islands belong to the animals, but they tolerate us humans there. Like, you know, normally, you know, you're lucky if you see a squirrel or whatever. Like, you know, I mean, we mm-hmm. have, you know, you have a bit of wildlife around, but usually they're scared of people. And in Galapagos, it's so different. The animals are just not scared of humans. So, I mean, you get like, you know, little sparrows or something that land on your plate or whatever, which I guess can also happen in other places. But one day, for example, I was sitting on a bench and this massive pelican just landed next to me, and I nearly like jumped off and ran away screaming because they're giant birds and it just landed next to me. It was like, oh my god, what's happening? But it just really calmly landed next to me and then just sat there, and I couldn't believe that it, like, such a giant bird would come so close. And it's the same with the sea lions. They're their beaches, and sometimes you will lie down on the beach and they're like, no, this is where we are, and they will chase you off. And the bigger ones can be a bit scary, so you definitely shouldn't start like an argument with something. If they chase you, you just go away. But
yeah.
The little ones are incredibly playful, and sometimes like I would get cold in the water after playing with them for a really long time, so I'd go like back up on the beach and they would follow me and like stay in the shallow water, and I would splash them with water and they would like duck down and then come back out. And yeah, it's incredible.
So how long were you there for in total?
In Galapagos, I think 3 weeks. Originally, my plan was to travel really, I mean, as I said before, I didn't really have much of a plan. But once I arrived in South America, I thought, okay, I could travel really slowly through South America and then Central America into Mexico, then skip the US. And then I wanted to kind of finish in Canada, which is another country I always wanted to visit. But then my sister got pregnant, and she's my only sister, and it's her first child. So I was kind of forced to speed up my trip a little bit. So I ended up skipping Central America and going directly from Colombia to Mexico. And mm-hmm. I spent another 3 months there, which wasn't anywhere near enough for Mexico. But yeah, had an amazing time there. So the flights from Colombia were going to Cancun, and I knew that I wasn't going to stay there. I knew I wouldn't like it. So it's just looking at other options nearby, and Playa del Carmen was kind of the lesser evil, I thought, but it still didn't really appeal to me that much. It's a destination where like loads of US tourists go to party and to go shopping.
Right.
And again, it was one of those places where I arrived and I couch surfed with someone super amazing who's become a really good friend. I ended up staying with him for something like 3.5 weeks in total. And I left my stuff and then explored the Yucatan Peninsula, and then I came back and did loads of diving there. I was really fortunate to meet a bunch of really amazing people who, realizing that I was at the end of my trip and I didn't have a lot of money left for diving, a lot of them took me along just paying the expenses, like just, you know, paying for the tanks and paying a little bit towards the boat fare and the petrol and whatever, but then just taking me diving for free and Cozumel, and where there's a beautiful reef, but also in the cenotes, which are the caves there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow, that sounds amazing. After Mexico, where were you headed? Were you heading home, did you say, to go and see your sister?
I was still in Mexico when my sister had a baby, but I had missed all of the pregnancy and I had already missed the first month of my nephew mm-hmm. after he was born. So it really became time to come back. So I was looking at kind of the cheapest way to come back home. And I was looking just at the cheapest flight from Cancun to anywhere in Europe, which happened to go to Milan. And I quite liked the idea that I had started my trip in Northern Italy, and then it came kind of full circle and I flew back into Milan. So I spent another 2 weeks traveling a little bit in the north of Italy, doing a bit more couch surfing there and visiting a few more places. And then because I'd gotten so into hitchhiking, I'd never tried that in Europe and I wanted to see what that was like. So I decided to hitchhike home from Italy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I did that. My mom picked me up in Hamburg because she said the last hour she just wanted to pick me up and not have me hitchhike. But yeah, I traveled from Northern Italy to Hamburg by hitchhiking with a stop in Munich.
Was it any different hitchhiking in Europe to elsewhere?
I only had two bad hitchhiking experiences, and one of them was on my last day hitchhiking in Germany.
Oh, no.
Yes. I thought that by then I was so experienced, and I always really trust my instincts and my gut feeling about people. And after that one bad experience I had in New Zealand, I thought, you know, if something didn't feel quite right, I just told them no thanks and waited for the next right. This last day, I don't know, I had a good feeling about this guy and I was so wrong about him. He just ended up being like a terrible racist. Yeah, he was very hard to bear. He said, I was only in the car with him for about 20 minutes and he came out with such shocking statements that I could have stayed with him for several hours. He was going almost like halfway to Hamburg. So it was, would have been a good ride, but he made my blood boil. And he had just come from Munich airport because he told me like some family was getting deported. I just looking at him and the way he was dressed and all, and he had like a dream catcher hanging there and all. And I was like, oh, like, were you like protesting it? He was like, God, no. So he was actually there to send them off. And he was a doctor who had to make sure that, you know, they were healthy enough to be sent away. But he basically just sent like, oh, you know, they faint and they come up with all sorts of heart issues and whatever, but it's all just a load of bullshit. And he was just horrible. I don't even want to repeat a lot of the things and words that he used, but I had to.
Not a good experience.
Yeah, I had to tell them to let me out at the next petrol station because it was just really scary. But after that, I actually, my final ride of the day was a Muslim family from Hamburg. And that was such a beautiful experience because it was starting to get dark and I was a bit nervous whether I would make it. I always tried not to do it after dark. And I saw this car approaching at the petrol station where I was. And then I saw that the woman on the passenger seat was wearing a headscarf. And I kind of like instinctively kind of took down my thumb and I was like, oh, they probably wouldn't take me along. And then I was like, oh, why did I do that? I don't know. But I just assumed. And they went past as well. But then they stopped and the couple got out of the car and they were both really kind of like smiling at me, but really shy. And they came up and were like, oh, we've never really done this before, but you know, you look okay. And where are you looking to go? It's like to Hamburg. Oh, that's where we're going. It's like, oh, get in the car. Yeah, it ended up being this really beautiful experience after I'd been in the car with this like terrible racist to be with this beautiful little family. They had like two kids in the back sleeping. And yeah, that was a good experience.
Oh, how wonderful. Yeah. What was the other experience in New Zealand?
Yeah, I think after hitchhiking in Japan, I had gotten almost a bit too careless because it's such a safe country. And also because of the language barrier and because people didn't really know what hitchhiking was, a lot of the time they would stop and ask me, what are you doing here? Why are you standing here? And I would say, oh, I'm trying to go to the city. And they're like, why are you not taking the train? And then, you know, we would have to really slowly with the translation apps and maps and whatever, try to explain what I was doing. So it usually took several minutes until I was in the car with people. And by then, it was plenty of time to suss them out. And this ride in New Zealand was probably only the third or fourth. I had just really arrived in New Zealand and I'd just gotten out of another car and the next car stopped and he smiled at me, was like, yeah, I'm going to Auckland, jump in the car. And I did. And the moment I did, I looked at him a bit closer as I was sitting next to him and I thought, oh, I'm not actually sure how I feel about him, but my bag was already in the trunk and I was already in the car and I didn't want to be rude. So I stayed in the car. And then as we were driving, it became very apparent that he was very high. He was driving like a maniac. And that wasn't the only problem. He was also just a terrible racist. He hated everyone. He had asked me where I'd traveled before. And when he heard Japan, he was just like, started talking about the war and how they're tortured in the war and whatever. And after I had just been to Hiroshima and Nagasaki and I had met survivors of the atomic bomb and spoken to them to then meet this guy, I got really furious. And he was so high that he kept forgetting that I was German. So I told him three times and then eventually I gave up because then he kept thinking I was British. He then started bitching about the Germans and how much he hates them because of the war. So then I thought, okay, I better not remind him that I am German. And then he just went on about everyone. He hated the Chinese. He hated the Jews. He just hated absolutely everyone. But in a way, I think looking back, maybe I needed that experience because it just made me a little more wary and it made me pay a bit more attention. And then after that, I always made sure to talk to people for a while before getting into the car. And I learned not to put my bag in the trunk, because I was thinking, oh, maybe I could say like, oh, I need to pee. Can we like stop somewhere and then just get out of the car? But he was so weird and scary. I couldn't really judge him that well. And I thought maybe if I get out now, that might actually set him off and, you know, it might make things more difficult. And because we were on a busy road going into Auckland, I thought I'm safer just staying in the car. But yeah, that day I just learned to trust my instincts a bit more and to take a bit more time before getting into the car.
Yeah. You needed that little reminder.
Definitely.
Well, it's amazing that you continued doing it, and well done for continuing doing it, because it has actually seen you through some amazing places, hasn't it?
Yeah. And a lot of my favorite memories, actually looking back, are hitchhiking experiences, because so many people completely went out of their way. There was a guy in Mexico who drove me something like 3 hours before he told me, oh, I really have to like turn around now and get to work. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he had picked me up close to Cancun, and he only then told me that actually he was on his way to go to work in Cancun, but he had decided to drive me to Merida, where I was going, which was a few hours away. And it was like, you didn't have to do that. And it's like, yeah, but I wanted to help you. And things like that happened all the time. I had so many people who drove several hours out of their way to get me to where I wanted to go. And yeah, there was really a lot of really great experiences.
You should write a book about it. So interesting. Do you know how many cars you got in the end? Do you have any idea?
No, impossible to count. But I very quickly started taking pictures with the ones that I wanted to remember, basically. You know, there were some that were just okay experiences, but more than half of them were quite special, and I didn't want to forget their faces, and I didn't want to forget what happened with them. And I'm not someone who takes a lot of selfies. I don't really like having my picture taken anyway, but I started because, you know, especially in a car, when you sit really close to people, you don't really want to like point a camera in their face. So I always, at the end of it, I always went like, oh, do you mind if we take a picture together? And I would like take a selfie with the people I was in the car with. And there's some of my favorite pictures from the journey, because I remember the conversations we had. I remember the stuff people told me. Like, it's amazing when you're, especially when you're in the car with just one person, how close you suddenly feel. And maybe it's because they know that you'll never see each other again, but some people told me really personal, really intimate stories, like about their marriage troubles, or this woman they just met and they're so in love, but they're not sure if she likes him back and whatever. And it's like, wow, it's really amazing that you're telling me.
You're like
this.
A therapist.
Almost, yeah. So yeah, a lot of my favorite memories are from hitchhiking, and I love looking back at those pictures. But yeah, it must be.
That is amazing.
Well over 100, probably a few hundred.
Wow. So you're back in Germany, you meet your new nephew.
Yes.
And then what is the plan from there? Did you decide that was it, or were you going to carry on with your travel journey?
Yeah, it was a really difficult time, actually. Obviously amazing to meet the little guy, and really nice to see my family again after all this time, but I very quickly fell into a very deep hole. I think a lot of people that travel for a long time kind of know that post-travel depression, and it definitely hit me particularly hard. And I was just faced with that decision, what do I want to do now? It's like, am I going back to London now? Do I want to live in Germany? Yeah. Am I going back to the music industry? And this idea that originally made me travel in the first place to find some clarity, it hadn't really worked out that well, because I came back still thinking like, I don't know what to do. And actually, I think I knew what I wanted, but I didn't quite have the courage to do it. I very quickly realized that traveling, I felt the happiest I had been in years, and so many years. So I knew this was making me happy. And while I was traveling, I kept thinking, I wish I could do this forever. Like this is what I want to do. And for some reason, I still felt irresponsible doing it, like, if that makes sense. There were a lot of,
well, it's the same being a season heir. It's quite similar, where you think you're going to get some clarity at some point, you're going to get this ping, and this is what I want to do, but you don't, you just miss what you were actually enjoying in the first place.
Exactly. And when I came back, there were a lot of friends and especially family who said, well, you've done this now, and you know, you've traveled more than most people do in a lifetime, and you did it now, but come on, now you got to come back to real life.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a few things that hit really hard. Like, you know, don't you think it's time to grow up? Don't you think it's time to be a responsible adult? And almost a bit like time to do what everybody else is doing. And I did already know at the time that, especially in Germany, all my friends were getting married, were having children, buying flats and so on. And I kind of already knew that wasn't what was making me happy. That wasn't never really something I was striving for. But at the same time, I still felt odd, like, yeah, being the odd one out. It didn't sit right with me. And I mean, I had met some amazing people traveling that really inspired me, but still among like my closest circle of friends, I think I was lacking some people to look up to who were doing something similar. So yeah, I felt really depressed when I came back, and then I spent Christmas with my family, but I decided I just need one more small trip, just like one more time out of the country. And
just one more.
And I had recently joined another Facebook group, which is a German Facebook group, but it's very similar to Workaway essentially. And I had seen a post in it where somebody was looking for some people to come help him in northern Norway in this tiny fishing village. And I thought, oh, that sounds cool. And I always wanted to see the Northern Lights. And, you know, I'm sure Norway is beautiful. So I contacted this guy and we immediately hit it off. Like, he's become a really good friend. And I think 2 weeks later, I was on a flight up to Norway. Again, I booked a one-way ticket, but I was looking at the return flights and it didn't make much of a difference whether I was booking the flight 2 weeks in advance or 2 months in advance. I thought, it's fine, I can come back in a few weeks. So I arrived there in this beautiful village that really feels like you're at the edge of the world, was abandoned for 20 years or something. And the guy I was staying with was the first to move back there and start building it back up. And there's like around 20 people living there. So it's very small. It's about, I think, 400 or 500 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle. You're so far from civilization, really. It's a very, very unique place. And I immediately fell in love with it. And then I was supposed to do some kind of work away, like, again, working in exchange for the room and the food. But Semyon, who I was staying with, knew that I was really broke after all this time traveling. So he said, you know what, if you want to, like, I could use some help with some other things and I could pay you a little bit for it. So I ended up working as a tour guide for him, because you'd occasionally get cruise ships come in to Lofoten, which is like kind of close to that where I was, it's further south from where I was, and Tromsø, which is near there as well. So I did 3 tours guiding in English and in German. And then suddenly the pandemic came around. And actually the last tour I did was AIDA, which is the big German cruise ship company. The people went back on board that day, and back on the ship, they were told that they had to cancel all the other stops in Norway and go straight back to Hamburg because all the ports were closing. And there were some other helpers at the time, and everyone panicked a little bit. It was like, okay, we have to get, like, you know, they had to get back to uni, and also they all jumped on the last flights back home. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not in a rush. There's nothing really waiting. So I don't need to, like, I wasn't ready to quite leave Nuuksund yet. They said it was going to be about 3 weeks. So it's fine, I can wait 3 weeks. It's not that long. So I stayed, and then I ended up staying quite a few more months because there was just no leaving Nuuksund, basically, because there's only one airport up there, and that was shut throughout the first lockdown. All the ports were closing. There are no trains up there, and the only way out would have been through Oslo, but I couldn't get to Oslo because the roads were all completely snowed under, so there's just no leaving that village where I was. So yeah, I spent the first lockdown from February till the summer in this tiny village, which was an interesting experience actually, because we were so far from everywhere that we didn't really experience the pandemic much. Like, it was watching a weird movie or something. Like, we saw it on telly and all and on the internet, but for us nothing much changed. I didn't wear a mask until the day that actually the airport opened again and I got a flight back to Germany, because up there nobody was wearing masks. Like, we use hand sanitizer a bit more often, and they put up some displays in front of the cashier in the supermarket, but that was it. Like, nothing else really changed.
Sounds like in a little place like that, with nothing coming in and nothing going out,
exactly,
it's quite unlikely to spread very far.
Exactly. The only thing that changed was that the tourists suddenly disappeared, but other than that, nothing really changed for us there.
I'm going to move on to my questions. We've probably covered half of them, but I'll read them all out anyway. As a WorkAwayer, you've obviously done a lot of different jobs. Can you tell us the best and the worst jobs that you've done as a WorkAwayer?
Yes. Well, I think all my favourite ones were all the ones that involved dogs, including your mum's. I love dogs so much. So like the ones I remember most fondly are the ones that had great dogs. But probably my favourite one was one that wasn't planned, the one I mentioned earlier. I was meant to be staying with somebody else who had forgotten that I was coming. So I contacted the next host and she arranged for me to stay with a friend of hers and her neighbor. Those two women, they were best friends and they were so smart and so funny. And they taught me to cook amazing Italian food. One of them had this gorgeous dog Pixie that I completely fell in love with, and they did amazing trips with me. Like they showed me the surrounding areas, they introduced me to so many amazing people. They introduced me to this organization called Lega Ambiente, which is an environmental protection organization, like a charity in Italy. So yeah, they took me along on loads of amazing excursions and I started to feel like part of their family. And when I left after I think it was 3.5 weeks or something, I was crying bitterly because we still talk a lot and I really want to go back and visit them because they were really, really special. In terms of the worst experience, although I wouldn't really call it, it wasn't necessarily a bad experience, but I guess one of the more unusual ones, that was the WorkAway that I did in Japan. So I stayed with a British guy who had moved to Japan like many years earlier. And he had bought an old Japanese farmhouse and completely renovated it. He had heard that I was traveling Japan by hitchhiking. So he was like, that's cool. We can meet in Kobe and hitchhike to my farmhouse together. So that was the first time I was hitchhiking with someone. And that's when I learned that it's a lot easier when you do it on your own, especially as a woman, especially when you're trying to hitchhike with a rather scruffy looking older guy. And we were standing at the side of the road for like 2 or 3 hours and nobody wanted to pick us up. And so the WorkAway hadn't even officially started yet. I was like, okay, this is not off to a great start. And then we got to this farmhouse, which was beautiful, like very traditional old Japanese house and very simple, very cold, but still like I really loved that place. But he was just quite a character. He was all about saving money or ideally not spending any money at all. So he made me dumpster dive, which was a new one for me. Like whenever there was a skip, he just had to stop and climb into it and see if there was anything worth rescuing. He particularly loved DIY stores. He said that they always have the best skips because they would like throw away, you know, like wheelbarrow that was like had a dent or missing a handle or had a flat tire or something. So he would climb in there and I would have to stand outside and he would like reach out all his like trophies and then I'd have to like take them down and then help him tie it up on the top of the car. And everybody obviously was just looking at us like, what the hell are they doing? I was just like, oh, it's so embarrassing.
Was he a bit of a hoarder?
He was, yes, totally. He really was. It's very sustainable. So in theory, I kind of like the approach, but I think he went a little bit too far. The other thing was that he didn't like to spend any money on food. Like the only thing we could buy was the stuff that had just gone off and was like heavily discounted because he was just like, why would you pay full price on food? So we were forced to just eat what was discounted, which obviously a lot of the time there wasn't a lot of choice. So it just meant that we were eating the same stuff several days in a row, which was quite interesting. And then I don't know if you know, but in Japan, all the different regions have mascots. And mascots in general are very popular in Japan. And yeah, they love them. There's like almost like this fan cult around them. Some of the mascots are like hugely famous and they appear on television and all. The mascot of that region where I was staying was this weird like pink little rabbit. Mm-hmm. This guy I was staying with had a really strange fascination with it, and he actually quite openly said that he was weirdly sexually attracted to the rabbit. And the rabbit's like everywhere. You see everywhere. It's like on top of, you know, street signs and whatever. It's everywhere. So every time we were driving past it, he would make some weird kind of sexual comment about it. And it's just like, okay, I mean, he wasn't being weird towards me, he wasn't being creepy towards me or something, so it didn't really matter so much, but it was very odd. And then after a few days, he said he'd have to leave for a while, but he would be back in like 2 days or so. And he never came back. He just left me in that house. And then occasionally he messaged me and said, oh, there's another workawayer coming. So another girl arrived from France. And then a few days later, a girl from Hong Kong. And they were both really lovely. But I think in the end, neither of them ever met this guy, Mark, because he just never returned. And so we were staying in this place in this freezing old, like, house, and we were a bit like, well, what shall we do? So we were kind of, you know, cleaning a little bit and picking some super weeds. But yeah, because he also wasn't like providing the food anymore, it's like, well, maybe we don't have to work 5 hours a day then anymore. That was just a very random experience, but I'm still quite happy I had it. It was, you know, it was an experience.
Yeah it's a story, exactly. For sure. Do you think it was his house? Do you think he was just a homeless guy who, like, found a building and was just like, may as well have some more people here?
You know what? I'm not sure. I really don't know. He was just a character. Very interesting guy, but yeah.
Awesome. In your opinion, what is the best thing about being a workawayer?
I think the best part about it is that really anyone can do it. Because when I first started thinking about traveling, something that was really holding me back was that I thought, I might be too old for it, which might sound stupid. I'm like 35 now. And, you know, at the time I was 32, 33 or whatever. But I still felt like, you know, oh, I'm probably like 10 years older than everybody else I'm going to be meeting and whatever. I mean, in general, there's no limit to how old you need to be to travel. But also with Workaway, there really is something for everyone. And I love that about it, because there's some stuff that can be quite physical, you know, like building works and things like that. But then there's also other things like taking care of children, or some people are really just looking for a housekeeper or somebody to look after their cat or something. One I saw that I didn't end up doing because I didn't make it to Buenos Aires, but it was one of the first profiles I looked at when I first found the platform. It was an old lady. She was like 80 something in Buenos Aires. She was looking for somebody to help her do the grocery shopping because she couldn't really carry it that well anymore. And she wanted some company. She said, you know, if you could occasionally like share a cup of tea and have a chat and maybe play a game of cards or something, that'd be really lovely. And that one really touched me. And if I ever go to Buenos Aires, I would love to stay with her, because there's a lot of things like that where people are just looking for some company. We've actually since started hosting Workawayers here now.
Oh, wow.
So when I came back from traveling, because we live in a sort of farm as well. So we're a family of 10. Mm-hmm. We have horses and dogs and a cat and quite a big property. So there's always a lot of legwork. And my parents aren't getting any younger. And my uncle and his wife live here as well, but they're not that young either anymore. And my cousin and I can't do it all on my own. And I'm not normally here. Mm-hmm. So I said, why are we not doing this? I've had such a great experience doing this. Why are we not getting some people here?
Yeah.
So we've started hosting Workaways here now. Just to give you an example of what it can be, the next Workaway is coming on Monday, and she's a 21-year-old girl from Denmark. After her, there's a guy coming from Uruguay, and he's 55 years old. I just really love that there's just no limit. Yeah. Like, you can be retired and you can still do Workaways. You can still travel with that, because there really is something for everybody.
With being a Workaway, was there any time you needed to apply for visas or anything like that in advance? Or was that all because you didn't really know, I guess, how long you were going to be and you were kind of short-term traveling around?
Yeah, I've actually been really lucky with that, because having a German passport, it opens a lot of borders very easily. So there were limits sometimes as to how long you could stay in places. But yeah, traveling in South America, for example, you usually just show up and show your German passport and then you get a stamp and you can stay for three months or something. Mm-hmm. The only time I ran into a visa issue was when I decided I wanted to go to Japan. And I was looking at the cheapest way of traveling there, and I found a Russian budget airline that was going, I think, from London to St. Petersburg to Moscow to another city I can't remember, and then finally to Tokyo. And I saw that it didn't matter if I was going directly and just, you know, having a short stopover, or if I stayed for a week in those cities, it didn't make a difference price-wise. So I thought, that's awesome. I can like visit a few places in Russia. And yeah, I always wanted to go to Moscow and St. Petersburg. So I was getting really excited about that. And I was sitting there with my credit card out ready to book the flights when it suddenly hit me, and I was like, do I need a visa for Russia? And then I googled that, and luckily I did, because yes, you do. And it's not actually that simple, because I think if you book it through like a proper travel agency, they take care of most of it through you. But I've never traveled through an agency, so mm-hmm. that didn't really apply for me. And you had to be in your home country and go to the Russian embassy there to get the visa. So that wasn't an option for me because I was looking to fly in the next few days. And also you need somebody in Russia to vouch for you and kind of, you know, write a letter that normally if you just book a proper hotel or something, they would do that. They would just like send you a really general letter like, we vouch for her. But I was looking to couch surf, and also it was a lot more complicated than I had realized. So I had to let go of that idea of visiting Russia.
Can you tell us about any challenges or difficulties you faced during your journey, and what did you learn from them?
Probably the most difficult experience of my trip was getting mugged in Lima.
Oh my goodness.
So I was mugged by two guys on the street. They took all my belongings.
Oh my God.
I don't really even want to go into too much detail, but I had been surrounded by people just before. I'd just overtaken a group of people. In the next moment, suddenly there were these guys, and I was like, but it's fine because there's loads of people around me. And suddenly everybody had just disappeared. And I only learned later on that that was because muggings are so frequent there and quite often so violent that people don't really dare to help anymore because a lot of people got stabbed or something trying to intervene. So everyone just ran off and went into hiding when it happened. So that was quite a scary experience, and I lost all my things. But
were you hurt or were you
No, I was okay. It was just I was very shaken, and it took a while to gain my confidence again.
Yeah, I bet.
But immediately it also showed me like, yeah, there's some bad people. Of course there's bad people out there, but there's also so much goodness in the world. And after that day when that happened, I experienced so much kindness all around. Like I was supposed to leave Lima that day, but I found a couch surfing host who took me in for 3 weeks, I think, because I had to stay. I couldn't leave Lima because all my stuff had been taken. So I had no papers, I had no bank cards, I didn't even have my glasses. Oh my goodness. And I'm completely blind. So I was wearing contact lenses at the time, but I had to get new prescription glasses and all. So many things needed replacing, my backpack and everything. And this guy, Percy, just took me in, not asking any questions. He helped me so many times. He drove me to the police station when I had to answer a few more questions and all. The German embassy as well were amazing. There were two women there who immediately burst out crying when I arrived there, and they immediately just took me in a back room and made me a cup of tea and like let me tell my whole story, which was a story that they taught me they heard every day and often a lot worse than what I had been through. They themselves had been attacked, one of them outside the embassy, which is obviously one of the nicer areas of Lima, but they were so kind. One of them gave me her spare phone so I was able to contact people. They let me contact my banks and my family so I could let them know that everything was okay, and you know, had to get the cards blocked and everything. That woman who gave me her phone, she even offered to take me into her flat because she said, oh, you know, my daughters go to university now, so I have a spare room if you need somewhere to stay for a few nights, which was so kind. And then a friend that I had met her for the first time in Patagonia, and she's become a really, really good friend since. She heard what had happened, so she skipped a few stops on her way to come to Lima to be with me. The first night that I saw her, she took along a guy that she had met that day in her hostel, an Australian guy who was listening to my story. And he was like, so, oh God, I'm so sorry this happened to you and all that. He insisted on like buying the dinner for me and her that evening. Aww. And like people were being so amazing immediately after this happened that it kind of just showed me that for all of the, you know, the few bad people that are out there, there's so many really, really amazing people. And it made me change my travel plans slightly because I really wanted to get out of Peru at the time. I just really needed a change of scenery, and I didn't feel comfortable heading straight kind of to, you know, Bogota or something, like one of the big cities. So I really wanted to just escape for a while and have a proper change of scenery. So I decided, I'd planned all along to learn how to scuba dive during that trip. Mm-hmm. So I decided to move that slightly forward. Normally I probably would have done it somewhere in like Taganga in Colombia or something, but I really wanted to go somewhere a bit more remote. And I found this dive school in San Andres, this small island in the Caribbean. It belongs to Colombia, but it's off the coast of Nicaragua. I went there, had the most amazing dive instructors I could have ever wished for. who also became really good friends. And they, it was my birthday while I was there, and they were really sorry for what had happened as well. So they ended up, you know, taking me for dinner on my birthday and gifting me free dives. And one of them saw me off at the airport. Yeah, I just had so many amazing experiences after that. And also I went through so many mobile phones on that trip. I lost one, I broke one, and yeah, one was stolen. Again, just as an example, like how amazing people are and how amazing people are to almost strangers, like people they've just met.
Yeah.
I only ended up buying one new phone, although I had lost three, because twice people I just met gifted me an old phone and were like, it's fine, just take
That's
it.
That's amazing.
And yeah, things like that happen very, wow. very often during my trip.
Well done for getting through that, because that is tough and it must have been a horrible experience. But yeah, the human kindness that obviously came after that just sounds absolutely incredible.
Exactly.
It's made me feel a little bit emotional.
Yeah, there was a moment at the embassy when the lady said, like, oh, we can like help you get a flight home. And I had never even considered like ending my trip. And I was like, home? No, I don't want to go home. And then I thought about it and was like, maybe I should. Like, maybe I won't be able to enjoy the trip from now on. Because I have to say, I was quite jumpy after what happened and definitely looked over my shoulder a bit more and all. But then I thought, no, I can't end my trip on a bad note. That like would have left a really sour taste. And I wanted to end it on a good note. So I kept on traveling. And I'm really glad that I did.
Whoa, what a story. What is one thing you wish you had known before you set off on your travels?
I wish I had known about Workaway before, because there were quite a few years when I was living in London when I didn't go on holiday. Sometimes I didn't go on holiday for like 2 years in a row or something, because I always thought that I depended on other people to go with. You know, sometimes the people that I would normally go on holidays with, they suddenly had a new boyfriend or something and they weren't available anymore to go travel with me. Mm-hmm. And it never crossed my mind that I could go on my own. And I think even the thought of somebody going on holiday alone, it sounds quite sad, which it's not. But back then I just thought, no, I wouldn't like book myself a hotel or an Airbnb and just go on my own. Like, that's what would I do with myself? It's funny, actually, because I don't know why I got this reaction a lot. Like when I went to a restaurant or when I checked in somewhere or something, I even picked up a car and the guy from the rental company stood next to me. He's like, are you Charlotte? Yeah. Stood next to me. And then we just waited. And after like 5 minutes, I was like, are we waiting for other like passengers or something? Like, what are we waiting for? And it's like, your husband. He's like, oh, there's no husband coming. It's like, okay, your boyfriend then. It's like, no, there's no boyfriend coming. What, it's just you? I was like, yeah, it's just me. I'm renting a car on my own. So, and he just looked at me with the biggest eyes. And then as soon as we got into, like, we had to drive a bit and we got into the like rental car office, I couldn't understand, but like it was so obvious the way he was like pointing at me and looking over that he was telling his colleague that I was traveling on my own and renting a car on my own. And the two of them just looked at me like it was like, wow, like who's this woman who does this? And it's like, really, is it that special? But the whole time in Greece, that continued. Mm-hmm. Every time I was in a restaurant, people would ask me where my husband is, same question over and over. And when I told them I was traveling on my own, so many times people would go, aw. I was like, why did you just make that sound? And they were like, oh, that's so sad, because they were like, oh, she's got no one to go with her. She's got no friends or something. And like in the beginning, I got quite offended. In the end, it just made me laugh, because every time, like the story repeated so many times, people felt sorry for me. But then they asked questions like, why are you traveling on your own? And how are you traveling on your own? Is it not really expensive and all? And I was like, actually, it's not that expensive because I'm doing workaways. And I told them about the whole concept of workaway. And by the end of all of those conversations, people weren't like, oh, that's really cool. Do you think I could do that? And it's like, yeah, of course you can do that. Because a lot of them had never like left their island, because they were like, no, it's too expensive. I'm not making enough money. And then I was telling them, you don't need to make that much money, because there's actually ways of traveling very cheaply. I mean, of course, to leave a Greek island, you might need to like catch a boat or plane or whatever. Mm-hmm. But once you arrive wherever you do your work away, you really don't have to spend any money because it's all included. So my first 2 months in Italy, I spent maybe 250 euros something. Like I just spend a little bit on like a glass of wine here and there and, you know, train or something, but you really don't have to spend a lot of money. And also when you travel with Workaway, you're not lonely because you're staying with locals. You immediately have the connection. Yeah, I think that's the one thing I wish I'd known earlier, that something like this mm-hmm. exists, and that is perfectly fine to go traveling on your own, because I would have done it a lot earlier.
Are there any other unlikely stories or memorable experiences that stick out to you throughout your travels?
One of my favorite memories that comes to mind was one of my hitchhiking experiences in Japan. I was coming from Hiroshima and I had couchsurfed there with a British guy and a Japanese girl and their French flatmate. And my plan was to go from Hiroshima to Nagasaki, which was quite a long distance. And my hosts were like, it's too far. You're never going to make it in a day. You can't. I thought it's fine because there's loads of towns on the way. So I can always stop wherever I end up and just find myself a bed for the night there. But I wanted to at least try it. So they drew a sign for me, in Japanese letters, because in Japan, everybody can read our letters as well, but it's easier and faster if you have it in theirs. Obviously, I couldn't even attempt to write Nagasaki. So yeah. They did it for me. So I was just holding up my little sign at a petrol station that was kind of on the road down to Nagasaki. It took 5 or 10 minutes for a guy to walk past and stop and just go, Nagasaki? Yeah. And he pointed at himself, Nagasaki. And I was like, no, you're kidding me. He's going all the way. And that ended up one of the best days of my trip. This truck driver, who was just one of the sweetest souls I've met that entire trip, he was coming from the northern island, Hokkaido, I think it's called, the furthest in the north. He'd been away from his family. He was from Nagasaki, but he had been away from his family for several weeks now, just, driving his big truck. And this was his final day of traveling before he could see his family again. He was really excited to see his wife and I think two little children and all. He never had taken a hitchhiker before. So he got me in the car. He was one of the very few Japanese people I met who was happy to speak some English. They all learn it, but they don't really like to speak it because they don't like to embarrass themselves and they might make a mistake or something. So they prefer to just not speak it. But he was like, oh, I learned it in school. It's not very good, but I try. So we were speaking a bit of English and then also using the translation app. And he asked me so many questions and I asked him loads of questions. And at least once an hour or so, he just looked at me with these big eyes and just went like, I can't wait to tell my wife that I picked a hitchhiker up today and a woman from Germany. And he was just so amazed by this. And he kept saying and my children, they won't believe this. It was such a sweet experience. And we had such great conversations throughout the day. And then it started to get dark and we were kind of approaching Nagasaki and he was supposed to leave the truck at a depot about an hour away from it. Mm-hmm. And then his car was there and he was meant to then take his car and go and see his family. So he had told me this a few hours earlier because we were in the truck together for, 12 hours or something. And he told me that he would pick up his car there. And it's like, yeah, that's cool. No worries. Take your time. He pointed out the depot and was like, normally I would go off here and go to that city. That's where I leave the truck and all. But I just get you to Nagasaki now. And I was like, what? No, what are you doing? Because you're going to Nagasaki anyway. I can wait and we can go together. And he just said, no, it's been such a long day. I really want to get you to Nagasaki now. And I was like, you haven't seen your family for weeks. And, you just need to leave the truck and grab your car. Let's just do it. And this made his journey another 2 hours longer after all these weeks that he'd been away from his family. And he insisted. He had this giant truck with another trailer attached to it. It was ginormous. And he drove me into the city center of Nagasaki as close as possible as he could get to the hostel where I was staying and then just dropped me and was like, just cross this bridge. And then it's there on the left.
Oh, that's so amazing.
He was the sweetest man. And I'm really sad that I didn't think to take his number or something because he really left an impression on me because he was such a sweet guy. And I was thinking of maybe contacting the truck company because I took a picture of the truck and it was like, oh, maybe I can find out who he was or something because I still think of him so often. There is another experience actually in Japan. I was in Kyoto and I was visiting a temple. I kept seeing these adorable, extremely old two women. They were tiny and they kept stopping people and asking them to take pictures of them in front of the temple buildings and all. And I was looking at them and smiling and they were just really adorable. And then they sat down in front of these beautiful red gates, and it just looked so pretty. And I ended up taking a picture of them from a distance. And I loved the picture so much that I ended up walking over to them to show them. They immediately just started talking to me in Japanese. And I was like, I don't understand. I don't know what you're saying. And this happened for like a few minutes. And I was like, they must understand that. I don't understand. But they just kept like chatting away. And then some guy walked past and was like, do you know what they're saying? I was like, no, I haven't got a clue. So he offered to be our translator. Bless him. It was really sweet. Turned out that one of the ladies had, when she was young, she was doing German dancing, like taking dance lessons. Oh, wow. So she loved the fact I was from Germany. And like, she was talking about all the different like dances that she was doing. And I know nothing about dance. So I was like, I wouldn't even know what that is. And then they started like taking pictures with me. I'm just like towering over these two tiny ladies, and I'm trying to look as like small as I can, but I still look like a total giant. And they were just chatting. And this guy couldn't even keep up with translating what they were saying. But one of them gave me a card at the end of it. And it was a beautiful card, like one I could read, and the other was in Japanese writing. And I always thought, once I return from my trip, I'm going to send her a letter. And just like, now I have a few Japanese friends, but I was thinking of like getting some help writing a letter in Japanese and to send her the pictures I took that day, because they were really special. And unfortunately, when I was marked in Lima, they took my wallet and that card was in there, and I'd never like written it down anywhere else or taken a picture of it. So unfortunately I lost it and I couldn't send them the pictures.
No.
Yeah.
Sad.
Yes. To be honest, I think the amount of times I heard from other people getting mugged, I mean, even friends in London who came to visit me, who were there for like a weekend, and nothing ever happened to me in London. And in 2 years of traveling, I only got mugged one time, I think. And I've been hitchhiking. Like, you know, it's not like I was playing it super safe. So I think I've been quite lucky.
Throughout all your travels, where feels most like home to you?
I think there's two places that feel like a second home. One of them is Italy. I think I might move there one day when I'm old and I don't want to travel anymore. I just think it's an amazing culture. I love the people and how much they are enjoying life and the good things in life. Mm-hmm. And it's such a beautiful country. Yeah, I've always felt really at home there, and spending 2 months there just really, really confirmed that. So yeah, and the other place is Mexico.
Really?
I arrived there and just immediately felt so comfortable there. Immediately met so many cool people. Yeah, I think I could live there.
Nice. When you were away, what did you miss most about your home country?
Bread.
Bread?
Yes, I'm German.
German bread.
Yes, it's true. I think you have to be German to understand our obsession with bread. But yeah, bread. You know, in France, you get very nice bread as well. In London now, if you go to like a fancy bakery or a market or something, you can definitely get nice bread as well. Italian bread is different, but it's still like, I love a good ciabatta at all. But other than that, people really don't understand the beauty of bread. And like so many places I visited, especially South America, it's just like you're eating cardboard. And it's like, why? So I was over the moon when I realized that in Chile, you can sometimes find proper German black bread with like loads of seeds in it in some of like the bigger supermarkets there, because Chile had loads of German immigrants. Some of that stuck around, so you can still buy German bread there.
Nice. Awesome. So if you could go back now and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would that be?
I think I would tell myself to not wait so long and to not doubt myself so much. It took me a really long time to build up the courage to do this trip. And I almost things had to get really bad until I felt like, okay, it can't continue like this. I'm really unhappy and I need to change something. Mm-hmm. And that was the moment when I was finally like, okay, no, I need to do something. And I decided to go on this trip. And yeah, I just wish I'd done it earlier. I don't regret the fact that I did this trip at my current age, because I think if I'd done it in my early 20s, I probably would have had a very different experience. I'm not sure if I would have appreciated a lot of the natural beauty I've seen quite as much. And, you know, probably my focus might have been more on partying and having fun and all.
Yeah.
So I don't mind seeing it from more of a grown-up perspective, but I definitely didn't need to wait this long. I probably could have done this a few years earlier, maybe in my late 20s or when I reached the 30 or something.
Yeah. On the topic of advice, what's the best piece of advice you've ever had?
It actually connects to what I was just talking about. I think the best thing somebody said to me was by this amazing woman I met in Patagonia, who's become a very, very dear friend since. She's a Canadian woman, French Canadian, in her 50s. She just showed me and told me so many times that you're never too old to live your dreams. And she was a living example of, if you don't want children, if you don't want to get married, you really don't have to. You don't have to do what everybody else is doing. If you're already not really that keen on it, it probably won't make you happy if you force yourself to live that life. You know, maybe you think society expects of you or others might expect of you. And she was the most kind of happy single person I have ever met, like living life to the fullest. And she's now in Angola. At the same time that she was offered that job, she was also offered a job in Barcelona. And she said to me, yeah, I thought about it briefly, but you know, I can do Europe when I'm old. And like she always chose like the most adventurous option. And yeah, I think I was really inspired by her adventurous spirit. And yes, she was a living example that you're never too old to travel. And I was already traveling at that time, but I do wish I had known her earlier because she's been really inspiring.
Yeah. Again, with the advice, what's the worst piece of advice you've ever been given?
So when I started traveling, and I still thought I would come back after a few months, like that's what I had told people, also told people in my old industry in London. So I was actually approached with a few job opportunities, which was great. It really didn't make things easier. I was kind of thinking like, why didn't those opportunities come up earlier? But then I probably wouldn't have gone on that trip. So it's, I don't know, it's a very good thing. But I was really torn because some of those opportunities were very, very exciting. And I was actually in Italy when I was approached about an opportunity, and they flew me into Berlin for 2 days to go for a job interview there and meet everyone. While I was there, I met some of my German friends. I was really torn what to do because I felt like the responsible thing to do was to take that job or one of the other jobs that I was being offered. They were all very exciting and definitely like a step up in my career. But really, I knew that I hadn't been this happy in such a long time. Mm-hmm. So did I really want to end this trip when I had already decided 2 weeks into that trip that I wanted to keep extending it? So I was really torn, didn't really know what to do. Someone said to me, well, what if you're never offered an opportunity like that again? Like you'll regret that for the rest of your life.
Oh God.
And that really hit me so hard because I was like, God, what if he's right? Mm-hmm. What if, you know, if I'm out of the music industry for too long and people forget about me or people think like, oh, she's too out of touch now. And they're not going to want to hire me again. And what if in a year or so I decide that I want to go back into it? So that sat with me for a really long time. And it really made me think, even when I was traveling in Japan and New Zealand and I had already turned it down, I was still thinking, oh, was this a big mistake? Was this a big mistake? And I was having a great time traveling, but it's still, that question still lurked. And I think it was only after a lot more traveling and now looking back, I'm like, no, it was 100% the right decision because I followed my heart and I did what was making me happy.
Yeah.
But yeah, that made me think a lot. And I thought for a very long time, what if he's right? Luckily he wasn't. But
definitely sounds like you made the right decision.
Yeah, definitely.
We talk a lot on the show about mentors. A lot of people have said they've had mentors along the way. Did you have any mentors?
I wish I had known someone before that had just done something similar. I know people that have traveled, but they all did it kind of around 20 or something, but nobody over 30 in my kind of close group of friends. And I think that would have really helped me at the time to make that decision. But Linda is definitely the person that inspired me the most because she kept encouraging me that you have to follow your dreams. You're never too old to travel.
Linda's the lady who's living
Linda
there.
Is the Canadian lady, yeah. She's the biggest inspiration. So yeah, I consider her a mentor still to this day.
Awesome. Do you have any books, movies, podcasts, publications, or anything like that that have helped you in your journey that you can recommend to our listeners?
there was a book that I read when the idea started to form in my head of going traveling. Mm-hmm. And my mom was actually telling a friend about the book, and I kind of listened up and was like, well, that sounds interesting. Can I borrow that book? It's a German book, though, and I don't think it was translated. It's called Das große Los. It's written by a German journalist. She actually took part in the German version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and she won $500,000. And she said that she always had this plan that if she wins enough money, she would use that money to go traveling. So when she won $500,000, she was like, cool, that's it, I'm doing it. And kind of similar to how I wanted to travel, she didn't want to just travel and be a tourist. She wanted to really live in different places. So she decided to choose 12 cities and stay in each one for a month and like get herself a flat there and really become a part of that city and live there fully. And it's, she wrote a book about that, and that book is beautiful. She was well over her 50s as well when she did the trip. I think she's over 60 now. And that book really encouraged me and inspired me. So that helped kind of push me a little bit as well towards this trip. And then since then, most recently, what's inspired me, I am actually quite fortunate to work on a very cool podcast as well called Nomad in Space. The two ladies that run it, Viv and Kit, they're digital nomads themselves, and it's a podcast for location independent women. And they talk all about their location independent life and everything that comes with it. And they often reflect on some of the social issues that might come with it, and they talk about everything with a feminist perspective. And yeah, they're one of my clients now, and I love listening to them, and they're two very smart, very funny women. I can recommend Nomad in Space.
Oh, wicked. I'm going to check that out for sure. Obviously, I love podcasts, so I'm excited to listen to that. And thank you for being the first guest that has recommended a German book as well. A lot of my listeners are in Austria. So a lot of Austrian listeners. So hopefully that will give them a little bit of inspiration as well. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Next, I've got to move on to Marg Lender's favourite question, which I ask all of my guests. It's a bit of a cheat question because it's two questions in one. But what's one thing you take with you everywhere you travel, or do you have any travel hacks?
It probably sounds a bit funny, but I took a knife with me everywhere.
You're the second one, actually, really? Of my guests who said that. Episode 2, Lara Parsons, she took a knife with her as well.
Good. I feel less weird then. So I only got it in New Zealand because I was couch surfing with a guy there who, they're called Opinel. I think it's a French brand. He said they're the best knives in the world, and he loved them so much that he didn't just use them when he was out and about because he was doing like loads of hiking and trail running and all, but he also used them at home in the kitchen, and he was a really passionate cook. So I used it a few times in his kitchen, and I thought, yeah, it is a really cool knife because it's not like a Swiss knife, but it does fold in to like the wooden handle, and it's very small and very light. A few weeks after he had introduced me to them, I saw it in a shop somewhere, and I thought, you know, I might get it. You never know what you'll use it for. And I thought, that's very stupid. I'll never use it. And I ended up using it almost every day. I'd never missed a knife before, but once I had it, there were so many uses for it. I used it all the time, like as a tool and to make my lunch when I was going on a hike and whatever. I used it all the time. And also sometimes staying in hostels, you get the shittiest kitchens with, you know, no sharp knives, nothing. So I was so happy to have that knife with me. And then the other thing, which I would highly recommend, which I also got into in New Zealand, and not just for traveling, just in general, I completely switched to just using shampoo bars as well as conditioner bars, shower bars. I used one for my face and so on. And I first saw them in New Zealand and thought, oh, that's cool. I'll try that. And it just changed everything because especially when you're traveling, it's super handy when you don't have to worry about, you know, the liquid allowances and airplanes and all. Yeah. It's also so much lighter. And then it's obviously better for the planet because they usually come like wrapped in cardboard or something, so you don't have all that plastic waste and they last forever. Yeah.
And most of them tend to be sort of organic,
exactly,
not full of chemicals. For you, when you were traveling, what was the biggest lesson learned?
I think that there's a lot of kindness and good people out there. I mean, even now, and especially before my trip, I sometimes feel a bit disillusioned about humanity and, you know, what we're doing to our planet and how what we're doing to each other. Yeah, and I have to say that sometimes I wasn't the biggest fan of humans in general. And then on this trip, I was met with so much kindness and generosity, and people who didn't know me did so much for me. Often, especially, you know, the ones that had hardly anything, they often seemed to be the most generous and treated me so amazingly. So it kind of restored my faith in humans.
For sure. If you hadn't made the jump to go and do the work away thing and the travel thing, what do you think you would be doing now?
I think I would probably still work in the music industry, possibly in London, although maybe now with Brexit, I might have moved to Berlin. I don't think I would be unhappy. Like, it was always a fun job, and I guess I wouldn't really know what I'm missing out on, but I'm really glad that I'm not anymore.
Is there a couple of people you would like to nominate to come on and have a chat with me?
Yes, definitely. The first person, surprise, surprise, is my friend Linda, who I mentioned before. Linda is just the funniest, most amazing person I've ever met. She can tell stories for years. I'm still amazed after knowing her for quite some time about all the places she's been and all the things she's done. She just never ceases to amaze me, and she's got a wicked sense of humor. She's lived in places like Mali, China, Vietnam. Currently, she's in Angola. She's lived with an Inuit community for a few years and, you know, skinned seals and whatever. And she has so many stories to tell, and she does so very well. So I'd love to nominate her. Then maybe Viv and Kit, or one or the other, from the Nomad and Spice podcast. They're both digital nomads, and they have been for a really, really long time. They've traveled all over the place, and they're really well connected in that community as well. So I think they would have some great stories to tell. And maybe my friend Becky. She's someone I only met after my trip. I've never actually met her in person, but I met her since I started working online. And she's been a digital nomad as well for a few years, travels together with a boyfriend and now with their dog as well. And she actually has her own community called Project Anywhere, which is also for location independent people. Wow. She's very good at connecting people and supporting people and helping them start their location independent journey as well. And yeah, I'm sure she'd have some great stories to tell as well.
Excellent. You said there you've started working online. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now.
Yeah, so these days I'm a virtual assistant. So when I was stuck in Norway for that time, I had a lot of time to think, and I knew that I wanted to keep on traveling by that point. So I was researching all sorts of ways how I could do that. I was looking at teaching online or all those different ways. And eventually I came across virtual assistants. I'd never really heard about that before. So I was looking into that, and there's so many different things you can do as a virtual assistant. At first I thought it's maybe something like a secretary or a personal assistant, but really there's no limit to what you can do. It just means that you're supporting people and working entirely online. So what I do now, well, it's really broad, but I do things like social media management and help people with their newsletters and their websites and blogs. Sometimes some general admin as well. And I occasionally do translations as well.
So you've managed to create a job for yourself to facilitate your travel lifestyle, which is quite amazing.
That was exactly the plan. I just wanted something that allowed me to be my own boss and choose my own clients and choose what I'm working on. And very importantly, to work from wherever I want to work from.
And did you have any kind of training in setting up your own business, or how did you go about that?
When I was in Norway, I came across a group on Facebook by this woman called Hannah Dixon, and she runs, I think it's called the VA Starter Kit. It was a free thing that I initially took part in, and then I ended up doing the course with her, which just teaches you some basics of like useful tools, you know, useful to know when you work remotely. And it also comes with a great online community that you can also find jobs through and so on. But I think I really learned everything on the job and with my first client. I was very lucky to actually, through her open community, and I can't think of their name, but she also runs a free Facebook group. And someone posted a job in there, and I thought, I could probably do that, although I've never worked with Squarespace and I don't know this tool and whatever. And I wrote to this guy, and he kind of hired me on the spot. And I told him, like, I've never worked as a VA. This is all very new to me. And of course, I've done some admin and whatever in my old job. But he gave me a chance, and He became my first client, and I actually landed another client through him, through referral, and yeah, learned everything on the job. But the community that Hannah runs has been really great just to get started and kind of get an idea of what's possible and what you can do as a virtual assistant, because that whole world was very new to me at the time.
So you've managed to sort yourself out a business where you can go and travel and be a digital nomad, as it were. What is next for you? Are you planning to stay in Germany for a bit, or are you going to be heading elsewhere? What's next on the cards for you?
I'm planning to stay in Germany a little bit longer, just because of the current situation that we're in. I never intended to move back in with my family ever in my life again. But also right now, there's kind of no place I'd rather be, because I have almost like my own flat here. It's a very big house and it's in the countryside. So even when there were the lockdowns, I could still go outside without any limitations every day. And it was a really good place to kind of start my business from and take the time to really look into it and find out how this all works. I've never been self-employed before. But my plan is to go back traveling. That's why I became a virtual assistant, so that I can take my job with me anywhere. And I'm really lucky that I have really awesome clients. They're all very international. Actually, three of them are digital nomads as well. And another one is a Canadian living in Denmark currently, but he's looking to relocate again soon. So they're very open to this lifestyle.
Yeah.
They're very understanding that I like to work flexibly and in my own time. We're always in different time zones, because like right now, one of my clients is in Australia and another one is in the US. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't really matter what time zone we're in. We usually tend to work at least a week in advance, sometimes a month in advance. So there's no tight deadlines that we need to stick to. So yeah, I can work very flexibly and in my own time. My plan is, whenever it feels reasonable to do so again, to get back on the road. Things still feel a little bit uncertain, so I'm a bit reluctant to like fully head back on this journey again, but the long-term goal definitely is to keep on traveling.
So if anyone wants to contact you to ask any questions or book you as a virtual assistant or see any snaps from your journey, where can they find you?
Well, I have to say, I'm not that active on social media. I do all the social media for my clients and I don't do a lot of my own, but you can find me on Instagram under MakeWavesVA.
We'll put some information in the show notes anyway, so that people can find you or see what you've been up to.
Great.
But Charlotte, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It has been so interesting and wonderful to see a different perspective, hear all about the work away stuff and a bit of general travel and how you managed to do it. So thank you for sharing your story, and yeah, good luck with the VA stuff. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure.
What an adventure. Thanks again to Charlotte for coming on the show today. So good to hear another perspective and an alternative travel journey. Don't forget to give us a follow on Instagram for all the latest information, and click subscribe on your favourite podcast player to get all new releases as they come out. Once again, a big thank you to Mike at Mike's Sports Bar for the studio space. Thank you to Mondo Wave for the music, and thanks to you guys for tuning in. See you all again next time.
Sorry, I've been saying your name wrong, haven't I? Charlotte.
That's good, actually. Yeah. But you can say Charlotte as well.